It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. This module, the first turning of the Dharma wheel, what the Buddha taught, is about what Shakyamuni Buddha, when he was alive, taught to those who were attracted to him. He taught the Four Noble Truths. Actually, when he was first awakened, he decided not to teach because he felt that what he had realized was too subtle for people and they wouldn't be able to understand. And it is said that when the gods heard this, they were very upset for the well-being of sentient beings and begged him to reconsider. So he did. And he taught the Four Noble Truths in the beginning, and he taught the Four Noble Truths in the middle, and he taught on his deathbed. There was one man who just insisted on being seen, and the Buddha agreed to see him and taught the Four Noble Truths to this person and then died. We should know that the Four Noble Truths, which include the Eightfold Path, are a complete way. They are prajna paramita, which is the perfection of wisdom, and by themselves will serve as for the rest of our lives. So this is something that all you really need to know is what we're going to cover in this module, which will be the Four Noble Truths and with a lot of attention on each of the eight paths in the Eightfold Path. Though historically, the Buddha's time was rich with spiritual seekers and new philosophies, people in general were not ready to hear about ultimate truths. And the Buddha, because he was a good teacher, taught very directly to the person that he was teaching. He intuited what the person needed and was able to take in, and he gave them that. The Buddha himself attained complete and perfect enlightenment. He knew everything that's included in all three turnings of the Dharma wheel, but people weren't ready to hear it. And so in studying the first turning of the Dharma wheel, as we will be in this module, we'll be studying conventional truths, which are the basic principles that underlie all of Buddhism. Because in the Mahayana, which arose about 500 years after the Buddha's lifetime, much of these basic principles were wrapped up in the teachings and trainings of the Bodhisattva. So before we continue in the line of the training and life of the Bodhisattva, I want to be sure that what's wrapped up in those ideas are clarified. So the Bodhisattva way of wisdom and compassion, which includes Zen, comes from the Mahayana, which is the greater vehicle. The lesser vehicle, the Hinayana, or more politely referred to as Theravadan, is about individual liberation as opposed to benefiting all beings, which is the Bodhisattva way or Mahayana Buddhism. Nevertheless, the Theravada teachings are rich and important, and they are what the Buddha taught first. So you'll find that they underlie everything that we do when we return to studying Zen and clarifying these principles now will provide a very strong grounding. For most of the edifying stories that I'll be using in this module are from Thich Nhat Hanh, his beautifully researched and tale-like rendition of the Buddha's life. The first two talks especially will be filled with these stories because how Siddhartha, the Buddha's name before he was enlightened, how he came to take such a strong action as to sit for, I think it was 6 days, and then all night until, along with the morning star and the earth and all beings, he was awakened. And that event is most powerfully imprinted, I think, by stories. So Thich Nhat Hanh told them beautifully. And as you listen, just allow yourself simply to take them in. They hug Buddhism in a stronghold. And like food, which spiritually speaking, these teachings are, you should just relish them. So close your eyes and relish them. I'll be telling you from Thich Nhat Hanh, thanks to Thich Nhat Hanh, some stories that will vividly show you kind of where the Buddha was coming from before he became a teacher. So we'll start with a story Siddhartha was told about a dream his mother had before giving birth to him. And so Siddhartha was Buddha's name before he was the Buddha, and Buddha means awakened one. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh. She dreamed a magnificent white elephant with six tusks descended from the heavens, surrounded by a chorus of beatific praises. The elephant approached her, its skin white as mountain snow. It held a brilliant pink lotus flower in its trunk and placed the flower within the queen's body. Then the elephant too entered her effortlessly, and all at once she was filled with a deep ease and joy. She had the feeling she would never again know any suffering, worry, or pain, and she awoke uplifted by a sensation of pure bliss. When she got up from her bed, the ethereal music from the dream still echoed in her ears. She told her husband, the king of the dream, and he too marveled at it. That morning, the king summoned all the holy men in the capital to come and divine the meaning of the queen's dream. After listening intently to the dream's content, they responded, "Your Majesty, the queen will give birth to a son who will be a great leader. He is destined to become either a mighty emperor who rules throughout the four directions, or a great teacher who will show the way of truth to all beings in heaven and earth. Our land, Your Majesty, has long awaited the appearance of such a great one." So for me, reverberations of the Immaculate Conception with great compassion and purity and wisdom, like Christ was conceived by Mary, for example, are manifold and brilliant in this dream. Unlike Mary, however, Queen Maya died 8 days later, and her sister raised the boy and lovingly served as his mother. The king, who definitely did not want him to turn out to be a teacher who shows the way of truth, but rather to be a mighty emperor who rules throughout the four directions, proceeded to do everything possible to make this happen. And but his controlling, of course, as things will be, propelled everything in the opposite direction, as we will see. So the story continues. Siddhartha's mother was named Mahamaya. A woman of great virtue, her love extended to all beings, people, animals, and plants. She was, it was the custom in those days for women to return to their parents' home to give birth. And Mahamaya was from the country of Kaliya. So she set out for Ramagama, the capital of Kaliya. Along the way, she stopped to rest in the Garden of Lumbini. This is very famous, this story of the Garden of Lumbini. People now, when they go on pilgrimage to India, always stop at the Garden of Lumbini. The forest there was filled with flowers and singing birds. Peacocks fanned their splendid tails in the morning light. This is Thich Nhat Hanh again. Admiring an ashok tree in full bloom, the queen walked toward it when suddenly, feeling unsteady, she grabbed a branch to support herself. And a moment later, still holding the branch, Queen Mahamaya gave birth to a radiant son. The prince was bathed in fresh water and wrapped in yellow silk by Mahamaya's attendants. And as there was no longer any need to return to Ramagama, the queen and the newborn prince were carried home in a four-horse carriage. And when they arrived home, he was washed and bathed. He was bathed again in warm water and placed next to his mother. Hearing the news, King Suddhodana, so Suddhodana is his name, Suddhodana, King Suddhodana, hurried to see his wife and son. And his joy was boundless. And he named the prince Siddhartha, which means the one who accomplishes his aim. Everyone in the palace rejoiced, and one by one they came to offer their congratulations to the queen. King Suddhodana wasted no time in summoning the soothsayers to tell him of Siddhartha's future. After examining the boy's features, they all agreed that he bore the marks of a great leader and would no doubt rule over a mighty kingdom that spread in all four directions. 1 week later, a holy man named Asita Kaladevala paid a visit to the palace. He was bent with age and he needed a cane to descend the mountain. And when the palace guards announced Master Asita's arrival, King Suddhodana personally came out to greet him. He ushered him in to see the baby prince, and the holy man gazed at the prince for a long time without uttering a word, and then began to weep, his trembling body supported by his cane. Streams of tears fell from his eyes. King Suddhodana grew alarmed and said, "You know, what is it? Do you forebode some misfortune for the child?" And Master Asita wiped the tears and shook his head. "Your Majesty, I see no misfortune at all. I weep for myself, for I clearly see that this child possesses true greatness. He will penetrate all the mysteries of the universe. Your Majesty, your son will not be a politician. He will be a great master of the way. Heaven and earth will be his home, and all beings his relations. I weep because I will pass away before I have a chance to hear his voice proclaim the truths he realizes. Your Majesty, you and your country possess great merit to have given birth to such a one as this boy. From the striking difference between the king's reaction versus Asita's, a wisdom master, we can clearly see in Buddhist teachings that they're called the three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion. We can clearly see greed, hate, and delusion motivating the king. He wants his son to take over and enlarge the power base of his land. He intends to have his way, arranging Siddhartha's experiences to generate that desire. He does this. The king arranges Siddhartha's experiences to generate the desire to be king and rule over the four directions. So for his entire youth, Siddhartha was protected from seeing anything other than the luxuries of the palace. This is the point. He was protected from seeing anything but the palace. And so he didn't get exposed to how people actually are until he was well into at least being, I would guess, a teenager, an older teenager. So the story continues. King Suddhodana increasingly feared that Siddhartha would decide to become a monk, as Master Asita predicted. An advisor suggested that he find a wife for Siddhartha, saying, once he has a family to occupy him, he'll abandon his desire. So his wife, the king's wife, Gotami, this is the sister of Queen Mahamaya, who is now raising him, promised she would arrange for Siddhartha to marry in the near future. So to that end, she requested the king and queen of Kaliya. The queen was King Suddhodana's younger sister, and their peoples had been close for a long time, to organize a martial arts competition on a large field that bordered Kunal Lake. And King Suddhodana personally presided over the event to encourage the young of his kingdom to develop their strength and increase their fighting skills. And all of the people of the capital were invited to attend, girls as well as boys. The young women did not engage in the athletic contests, but encouraged the young men with their praise and applause. Yasodhara, the daughter of Queen Pamita, was responsible for welcoming all the guests. She was a lovely, charming young woman, her beauty natural and fresh. Siddhartha, of course, placed number one in all the events, including archery, swordsmanship, horse racing, and weightlifting. And it was Yasodhara who presented him with a prize, a white elephant. So with her palms joined and her head slightly bowed, in a voice noble and serene, she declared, please accept this elephant, Prince Siddhartha, for your well-deserved victory. And please accept my heartfelt congratulations. The princess's movements were graceful and unaffected, and her manner of dress elegant and refined. Her smile was as fresh as a half-opened lotus. Siddhartha bowed and, looking into her eyes, saying in a quiet voice, thank you, princess. Devadatta stood behind Siddhartha, unhappy to have won only second place. Upset that Yasodhara had not even noticed him, he grabbed the elephant's trunk and viciously struck it in a sensitive spot. Overcome with pain, the elephant dropped to its knees. Siddhartha looked severely at Devadatta. "Cousin, that was outrageous." Siddhartha rubbed the tender place on the elephant's trunk and spoke soothingly to it. Gradually, the elephant stood up again and bowed its head in respect to the prince. The spectators applauded loudly. Siddhartha climbed upon the elephant's back and the victory procession began. Under the guidance of its trainer, the white elephant carried Siddhartha around the capital of Kapilavatu, and the people cheered, and Yasodhara walked beside them in slow, grateful steps. I'm telling you this story because later it's going to be really significant in the events once Buddha has established his monastery. So I want you to hear the background of why people behave the way they do later on. And so there's one other incident that I want to report to you that also caused Devadatta great jealousy. And in this story, it's Siddhartha talking to the children who lived near the forest where he attained enlightenment. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh telling the story of Siddhartha talking to the children. And Siddhartha says, "Let me tell you a story about when I was a boy. One day when I was 9 years old and strolling alone in the garden, a swan suddenly dropped from the sky and writhed on the ground in front of me in great pain. I ran to pick it up and I discovered that an arrow had been deeply penetrating one of its wings. I clasped my hand firmly around the arrow shaft and yanked it out, and the bird cried as blood oozed from its wound. I applied pressure to the wound with my finger to stop the bleeding and took the bird inside the palace to find Sudari, a lady in waiting. She agreed to pick a handful of medicinal leaves and make a poultice for the bird's wound. The swan shivered, so I took off my jacket and wrapped it around her. Then I placed her close to the royal fireplace, and I was about to go find some rice for the swan when my 8-year-old cousin, Devadatta, burst into the room. He was clutching his bow and arrows, and he excitedly asked, 'Siddhartha, did you see a white swan fall down near here?' Before I could answer, Devadatta saw the swan resting by the fireplace, and he ran toward it, but I stopped him. 'You may not take the bird.' My cousin protested, 'That bird is mine. I shot it myself.' I stood between Devadatta and the swan, determined not to let him have it. I told him, 'This bird is wounded. I am protecting it. It needs to stay here.' Devadatta was quite stubborn and not about to give in. He argued, 'Now listen, cousin. When this bird was flying in the sky, it didn't belong to anyone. As I'm the one who shot it out of the sky, it rightfully belongs to me.' His argument sounded logical, but his words made me angry. I knew there was something wrong with his reasoning, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. So I just stood there speechless." This is Siddhartha, becoming more upset. "I felt like punching him. Why didn't I? I don't know. Then I saw a way to answer him. 'Listen, cousin,' I told him. 'Those who love each other live together, and those who are enemies live apart. you killed the swan, so you and she are enemies. The bird cannot live with you. I saved her, bandaged her wound, warmed her, and was on my way to find food for her when you arrived. The bird and I love each other, and we can live together. The bird needs me, not you. So his reasoning is what's best for the bird. Like, well, you know, what a concept. What's best for the bird? And in the end, they couldn't agree, and they had to take it before the king and his ministers. And since Siddhartha was the king's son, even though the ministers actually all sided with Devadatta, I mean, all of them sided with Devadatta, they were shamed out of voting for him. And so Siddhartha said, I had the bird, but so they gave it to Siddhartha. So I had the bird, but I wasn't really happy. Even though I was still young, I knew that my victory had been less than honorable. I was given the bird because the ministers wanted to please my father, not because they saw the truth of what I said. And he goes on, in this world, few people, and just look at our world right now, 2,500 years later. So think of our world 2,500 years later. And now this, I'm going to read you what Siddhartha said. In this world, few people look with the eyes of compassion. And so we are cruel and merciless toward each other. The weak are always oppressed by the strong. I still see that my reasoning that day was correct, for it arose from love and understanding. Love and understanding can ease the suffering of all beings. The truth is the truth, whether or not it is accepted by the majority. Therefore, I tell you, children, it takes great courage to stand up for and protect what is right. So he was still talking to the children. So again, I'm presenting these two stories because I want to provide a history and a cause, if you will, of the schism that Devadatta later created in the Buddha's community. Creating a schism in a sangha is a major spiritual crime. And Devadatta blatantly enacted it and almost got away with it. And I'll tell you that story in due course, not today. But it was pretty critical, actually. So eventually, Siddhartha had reason to venture out of the palace, and immediately he saw old age, sickness, and death. Immediately, the realization of impermanence of all phenomena struck him like a thunderbolt. Where there is life, there will certainly be death. No matter man or woman or young or old, no one can escape this fate, he thought. And then because of that, the teachings of impermanence are the bedrock of Buddhism. And here is the teaching. So this is me telling you the teaching. When we awake to the reality of emptiness, which means that all beings have no fixed nature. Everything is impermanent and therefore always changing, so that it is empty of an individual fixed identity. Here's the voice of Shakyamuni, actually. Shakyamuni Buddha speaking on emptiness. It's very short. But so listen to what Shakyamuni says about emptiness. And he's addressing his bhikkhus, his students, his disciples. Bhikkhus, emptiness does not mean non-existence. It means that nothing exists independently. Emptiness means empty of a separate self. As you know, the belief in being and the belief in non-being are both incorrect. All dharmas depend on each other for their existence. This is because that is. This is not because that is not. This is born because that is born. This dies because that dies. Thus, the nature of emptiness is interdependence. We'll come back to this again and again and again. These ideas of impermanence and interdependence are absolutely fundamental in Buddhism. So the reality of impermanence and constantly changing identity is like a famous verse at the end of the Diamond Sutra, which says that not just our life, but all conditioned things are things that are created or put together. Anything that's created or put together are like a dream, a phantom, like bubbles or shadows, a flash of lightning or a dewdrop. So we should see that all conditioned things as a dream. Our life is like a dream. Our life is like a dream within a dream, actually. We and all things in the world are empty, and within emptiness, we talk about emptiness. Whenever you hear the word empty in Buddhist teachings, it always means interdependence, or empty of an inherent individual self. So again, when you hear the word empty in Buddhism, let's just leave it at interdependence. It means interdependence. So it's not like you drink a Coke and your glass is empty. It's interdependent. All things are interdependent. So fundamentally, the teachings of the Buddha spin around the following logic, because I want to spell this out really clearly for you. So this is the logic. There's five, one, two, three, four, five. There's 5 points in this stream of logic. Everything is subject to cause and conditions. Cause and conditions are karma, basically. Karma is where there's an effect, there's a cause. So, and everything is subject to causes and conditions. This is why karma is so important in Buddhism. It's like the rock bottom of the five causes. So everything is subject to causes and conditions. Because causes and conditions are constantly changing, everything is impermanent. You know, we're like, everything is impermanent. And because this is this, because that is that, there's interconnectedness. Therefore, there can be no inherent, independent, individual self. Everything is one. That's how it goes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Impermanence is the basis of suffering. And suffering in Buddhism means old age, sickness, and death, which is inescapable. Awakening removes us from this cycle. With awakening, there is neither birth nor death. And we'll talk about this in a future module, but just imagine this. What Buddhism is all about is awakening from what we normally think of as our inherent individual self, and awakening from birth and death. Awakening from birth and death. That's what Buddhism is about. It's really as basic as it can possibly be. And I think a lot of people don't even realize that. Many people feel Buddhism is like a religion. You have to believe something. But it's not. It's about awakening. And when awakening happens, there is no birth and death. So because of impermanence, there's nothing we can rely on. And yet this phenomenal world of things on which we cannot rely is the only reality in which we live and work. So the world of things is called Dharma, and Dharma is the only thing we can rely on. And Dharma means things constantly change, everything comes to an end. And so right now, right here is what we have. That's what Dharma means. Right now, right here is what we have. That's the Dharma. Right now, what here, right here is what we have. And this is also the nature of our Zazen. Zazen is not a method to find truth or reality beyond this phenomenal world. Zazen is just being right now, right here. Our mind is always changing. Our physical condition is always changing. We often deviate from our Zazen and then try to return to it. This process of constantly returning is the most important point about our Zazen. This is really important. And this is partly why Zazen is not meditation. Zazen is Zazen. It's a separate thing. Okay. So I've said a lot, and here are the most important points. Please reflect on them deeply and try to relate them to your life as it is right now. And if you can write about your thoughts, you'll integrate them more thoroughly. And in fact, one person, I think this is so wonderful. One person created a document for all of the questions that have been asked so far in all of the talks. So starting early in series two, she created a document listing all of the questions and answering them. And then that provides a forum for going back later with greater understanding and re-answering them and filling everything out. And then you have a kind of document with all of it together. I just think it's a wonderful idea. So, okay, so here are the five most important points that I've made today. First are Siddhartha's words. In this world, few people look with the eyes of compassion, and so we are cruel and merciless toward each other. The weak are, when I read this, I'm thinking of Afghanistan. I mean, just, ugh. The weak are always oppressed by the strong. I still see that my reasoning that day was correct, for it arose from love and understanding. Love and understanding can ease the suffering of all beings. That's point one. Secondly, this fivefold stream of logic that I created to help simplify and clarify the kind of basic logic that underlies all of Buddhism. So fundamentally, the teachings of the Buddha spin around this logic. One, everything is subject to causes and conditions. And that means karma. So everything is subject to karma. Because causes and conditions constantly change, everything is impermanent. Because this is this, because that is that, there's interconnectedness. Therefore, there can be no inherent individual independent self, and everything is one. That's Buddhism right there. Okay, the third important point was impermanence is the basis of suffering. So because we, you know, I am impermanent, there's going to be old age, sickness, and death. And that's inescapable. And awakening removes us from this cycle. So within awakening, there is neither birth nor death. Fourth, Dharma means that Dharma means things constantly change, everything comes to an end. Right now, right here is what we have. So you can shorten that to Dharma equals right now, right here, being present, present moment. That's what we have. That's all we have. And fifth, this is also the nature of our Zazen. I mean, Zazen boils down to right now, right here, and stay there. And when you veer away, you bring yourself back. And it's the bringing yourself back. That's the important point of Zazen. It's very profound, actually. Okay, so that's number five. So I see there are some questions. I was struck with the idea that being right now, right here, and constantly returning to this is the main point of Zazen. How is Zazen different from meditation? How is that? Meditation means we meditate on something. But in Zazen, there's no on something. There's nothing but right now, right here, and constantly returning to this. That's why Zazen is often, we call Zazen sitting practice. And sitting practice is often said to be the same as enlightenment. There's nothing outside ourselves, and this is enlightenment. There's nothing outside of right now, right here. And so in a way, how could it not be? I think that's really the question. How could it not be? But just veering back to the question, Zazen is different from meditation because it doesn't, there's nothing on which the Zazen practitioner is focusing other than just being present and staying present. And it's very hard when you try to just sit, which is called shikantaza for us. It's very hard and you veer right away. And this constant bringing back is a basic, it's a very basic practice, but it's different from kind of like if you meditate, you can have somebody even talking to you and talking you through some idea or some scan of your body or some way of thinking. None of that has anything to do with zazen. That's all. So here's another one. This may sound like a silly question, but how did Siddhartha's wife, Yasodhara, feel about his leaving? I know. Because once he saw old age, sickness, and death, he couldn't stand it. And he had to do something about it. And so he left to become an ascetic and then later sit for a very long time before he became awakened. But Yasodhara was left behind. And I think they had a child by then, Rahula. So Yasodhara was very connected with, they were very happily married and they were very connected. And she, at one point she recounted three dreams to Siddhartha that worried her a lot. They were like omens that he was gonna leave. And here's how Thich Nhat Hanh describes this this little event. Siddhartha fell silent and then consoled her. "Gopa, please don't worry. You are a woman of depth. You are my partner, the one who can help me to truly fulfill my quest. You understand me more than anyone else. If in the near future I must leave and travel far from you, I know you possess the courage to continue your work. You will care for and raise our child well. Though I am gone, though I am far away from you, my love for you remains the same. I will never stop loving you, Gopa. With that knowledge, you will be able to endure our separation. And when I have found the way, I will return to you and to our child." So what I'm amazed at in the story is because of that, Yasodhara actually helped him leave. So he's about to leave her and, you know, endlessly. He may never come back if he doesn't find the way. He's about to leave her, and he says this to her, and she goes to the stables and asks the his attendant there. He asks his attendant to get Kantaka, the Siddhartha's horse, ready. "Please prepare Kantaka because Siddhartha may need him tonight." So she actually went and assisted Siddhartha to leave her. I don't know that a lot of women would be able to do that. I think it's just really quite wonderful. And so the end of the story of that, the end of that story is that Siddhartha did attain enlightenment and he did come back. And after he established his monasteries, his aunt, his stepmother, arranged for a whole group of women, including Yasodhara, to become barefoot and shave their heads, and they walked to Buddha's monastery and begged to become admitted. And the Buddha wasn't going to do it because I think there were too many complications, like what people would think if there were women in his monasteries. And it would just be, you know, the gossip and all of that would just be too overwhelming. And he was really ready to say no after all of that. And his assistant Ananda pulled him aside and said, you know, women are just, well, he said, are women as able to attain enlightenment as men? And the Buddha said, yes. And and Ananda just insisted that they be allowed. And I'll tell you all this later in more detail, but and so what actually happened is right then and there, they were women, because of this, women were allowed to enter, to become monastics themselves. Separate monasteries were built and facilities were built for them, except there were 8 rules they had to follow. And in due course in this module, I'll tell you those. I don't know them off the top of my head, but a lot of them had to do with how they regarded the monks. They needed to regard them very, very highly. And if a monk said something, you know, that was the law. They just couldn't even argue it. They were very strict. There were 8 very strict rules, but I can't remember her name now. The Buddha's mother, basically, the woman who raised him. Prajnapati, I think that was her name, Prajnapati. I have a statue of her right by my desk. This is Prajnapati, if you can see. She is the one who started monasteries for women, Buddhist monasteries for women. And so I hold her in such high regard. I have her next to me at all times, basically. And so someone asked, who is Yasodhara? And I just want you to know that she was, this is very interesting, her qualities of generosity. She worked in the village with the sick and the poor, her qualities of generosity, loving speech, beneficent conduct, and likening herself to others. That is, she treated others like she would want to be treated. Those 4 qualities, generosity, loving speech, beneficent conduct, and treating others as you would like to be treated. Those 4 qualities, they are called the 4 embracing dharmas. And the Buddha taught those 4 embracing dharmas, and they remained dormant until Dogen. Dogen, no Zen master before Dogen, taught this particular teaching of the Buddhas, but they totally describe Yasodhara, and we'll come back to them later. They're very special. They're very, very special. Generosity, loving speech, beneficent conduct, and treating others the way you would like to be treated. They're called the 4 embracing dharmas. The Bodhisattvas 4 embracing dharmas. The Bodhisattvas 4 embracing dharmas. Okay. And I see one more question. The story about the swan was so powerful. Even today, almost every everyone would side with Devadatta, even without giving it a thought. If you kill an animal, it's yours, right? When you really think, I mean, really, if you kill an animal, it's yours. But actually, I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, this idea that this is 2,500 years ago, and that, and I've seen movies of the Queen of England, in the gear of a hunter, crawling on the ground with her rifle, and shooting her animal, killing her animal. And she, the queen, she's the Queen of England, and her actions are so primitive and morally crude, just like 2,500 years ago. Go figure. I mean, really, go figure. So I want to thank everyone for attending, and I want to thank my team, Sahar, who was not able to be here today, and Brian, who was able to be here today and substituted for her, and Brendan, all those who make this presentation possible, and work very hard to do so. Thank you so much, and I'll see everyone next week. Bye-bye.